Kim, thanks so much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. You can reach us, you know, at 312-981-7200. That's the call line and the text line. A couple weeks ago, I saw an article in the Washington Post that I was incredibly alarmed about. It has to do with the oceans and how they're changing, and not for the better. Joining us right now on the phone is Jonathan Payne. Jonathan is a geoscientist and associate professor at Stanford University. Jonathan, I can't stress this enough. I read this article, and it's mind-boggling the changes that are happening, and happening rapidly.
Yes, the world is certainly changing fast, and the I think many people are aware of the changes on land, but the changes in the ocean are catching up quickly, and so it's something that's important to pay attention to.
I didn't read the article, and many of us haven't, so I just want to have a few questions. Now, is this due to pollution? Is this due to human to environmental? What is causing this undersea change?
Right. So the study that we did was aimed at comparing the changes that we see in the ocean today based on assessments of extinction threat to fish, marine mammals, as well as marine clams and snails. And we compared those to patterns in the geological record. What we found is that in the modern, having a large body size is very strongly associated with being threatened with extinction, whereas that's not the case in the ancient extinction events, many of which are actually associated with the same kinds of climate warming and changes in ocean chemistry that we see today.
So you would almost assume naturally that your larger animals, your larger mammals would fare better under something like what's going on right now, but it's quite the opposite. The larger are the ones that are suffering the fastest, huh?
That's right. So in the past, what we've seen actually is that body size has relatively little to do with extinction threat, whereas having a large body today makes you much more threatened. We didn't directly assess why that was the case, but there's been quite a bit of research in the past, and that all points toward human hunting and fishing activities as being the most likely source of this very strong size selectivity or size bias in extinction threat.
In the article, you refer to what's going on as the sixth mass extinction. Describe exactly why we're going through what would be considered the sixth mass extinction.
Right. So the sixth comes from the fact that when we look at the geological record, particularly the record of marine life, in fact, what we see is that there are five major extinction events in Earth's past that have really been catastrophic and changed what the Earth looked like biologically, essentially permanently in a couple of cases. The most recent of those is the asteroid impact that ended up killing the dinosaurs, as well as many different types of marine animals. The ammonites, a large group of cephalopods, so relatives of squid and octopods that had a big coiled shell, those are probably the most famous marine victims of that extinction event. And that was 66 million years ago, so it's been quite a while since the oceans have experienced that magnitude of biological change.
All right, I'm confused about this. Now, you know, you watch SpongeBob and everybody's getting along, you know, in where he lives in a pineapple under the sea. What is exactly causing this?
Right, so a lot of this, appears to be human hunting and fishing activities. We know that in the past, whaling activities have impacted population sizes of many whales. And what we're seeing is that extinction threat to fish, which have many, many more species than whales, they're also feeling the pressure from the scale of fishing that we're able to do these days.
So as one species disappears, that affects another type, correct?
So there's probably some of both going on. There's probably some direct human impact and probably also some indirect impact where when one species is removed, other species are affected. So the good news here is that what we were looking at is extinction threat, not extinct species for the most part. And so what that means is that we still have the opportunity to reverse this pattern. These species are threatened, but they're not actually gone from the oceans yet.
Well, that's a good thing. And what can we do to help?
Right. So there are a couple of things we can do to help. One is to, when we go out and vote for government officials that we believe are going to take action to create the types of marine protected areas that we need in order to allow populations to survive. So none of us want to argue or are arguing that we shouldn't be fishing in the seas. It's an important source of income for many people. It's an important source of food for many people. The key thing is to do it in a sustainable way. And what that likely means is some larger protected areas and some protected areas that are targeted at the places that best preserve the populations of the species that are threatened.
But Jonathan, this is a global issue, and it obviously is, it's not just contained within the United States. Our votes can't really matter in other parts of the world, or can they?
Oh, they absolutely can. And the reason for that, of course, is that our government negotiates with other governments over all kinds of activities, from hunting and fishing activities to carbon emissions, as well as, of course, international treaties, you know, related to defense. And so it absolutely makes a difference, who we vote for and how our government then interacts with other governments to make these decisions. You're certainly right that we can't do it alone.
Yeah.
Right? We need governments from other countries to work with ours. But the most we can do is to get out there and try to control the parts that we can control. In the same way that when I go out and drive on the highway, I can drive safely. If somebody else, crosses over, God forbid, and runs into me head on, there may be nothing I can do.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that I should go out and be careless.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right.
And, everybody's telling you to eat more fish because it's good for you, the omega fatty acids or whatever they are, oils. Tilapia has been likened to worse than bacon for you because of the farms that they're raised in. So can we go and eat fish from the ocean, or what should we do?
That's right. So, there are fisheries that are more and less sustainable, and the Monterey Bay Aquarium produces a list that's targeted both at the East Coast and at the West Coast of the U.S. because, of course, we tend to get fish from different areas, and they actually have categories of fish or seafood in general that is viewed as the most sustainable and that's viewed as better than the worst choices, and then things that are not sustainable and that would be better to avoid. And so they produce an app for your cell phone. They also in the old days produced a cardboard card. A couple of years ago. And so you can go out and get information from the Monterey Bay Aquarium where they're reviewing on a constant basis which fisheries are well managed and which ones are not. And that way, you don't need to avoid seafood, but you can at least target your choices toward the fisheries that are sustainable and that are not creating extinction threats.
Jonathan Payne is our guest, a geoscientist, associate professor at Stanford University, part of this article that I read in the Washington Post about the sixth mass extinction. Jonathan, I know you don't have time to go into great detail here, but just really quickly, talk about the trickle-down effect that it has on us, on humans. It does a nice job of that in the article, but what exactly is the cause and effect as these larger animals and mammals are having a hard time sustaining in the oceans? What does that mean to us?
Right. So it means a couple things to us. In some areas, ecotourism is extremely important. On the West Coast here, going out whale watching is one of the activities that brings tourists to our area. Recreational fishing does that as well. And so certainly losing these populations has an economic impact on the parts of the country that depend on that kind of tourism. In a broader sense, these large animals have big effects on the ecosystems that they're part of. And so as we remove them from the ecosystems, we can have cascading effects. One of the most interesting examples of this that people may not be familiar with is there's a large predatory snail called Triton that eats starfish.
Mm-hmm.
And starfish turn out also to be predators. And there's one starfish called the crown of thorns starfish, which is a big one with big spikes coming off its back. And it likes to eat corals. And so people have been collecting the tritons for their shells, and an inadvertent side consequence of this is that the populations of the crown of thorns starfish have increased a lot in certain areas, and they go around and eat the corals, and then the reef ecosystems are degraded as a result. And so although nobody was hunting the snail with the intention of degrading the reef ecosystem that, you know, supports a lot of tourism and a lot of species, that has been an inadvertent side consequence of that. More recent work also suggests that even marine productivity just in general is enhanced by the activity of whales. So when a whale defecates, it produces actually, you know, it's warm coming out of its body, and so the material tends to rise. And that brings nutrients back to the algae that photosynthesize and create food for the fisheries that we depend on. And so there are even things like that where removing these big animals may actually end up reducing the nutrient cycling and leaving us with fewer fish to eat.
Who would have thought it all resulted with whale poop?
That's, I mean, how
really?
It is.
Are you going to tell Jonathan what you're having for lunch?
I was going to have a lobster roll for lunch, but now I'm rethinking it, Jonathan.
Well, what I would suggest is take a look at the Monterey Bay Aquarium list and check and see where your lobster's from, and it may be sustainable.
So all right. Well,
take a look before you decide to avoid it.
I may just have a Hot Pocket. You've changed my mind.
Well, this is pretty fascinating and yet scary, quite honestly, Jonathan. Thank you for talking to us about this. And you can go, it's the seafoodwatch.org through the Monterey Bay Aquarium. I will look up lobster for you.
See Bill. How they look on the list. Jonathan, thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
You too. That's Jonathan Payne, a geoscientist and associate professor at Stanford University. And I'm guessing we're the only show he's talked to where we referenced SpongeBob.
Right.
He loved it. He loved this SpongeBob
reference.
Well, you
know, he was talking very technical, right. And I was trying to, you know, put it down to my level so people could understand.
That's great. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.